This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Bicycle, bicycle, bicycle.
I want to ride my
bicycle.
I want to ride my bike. I want to ride my bicycle. I want to ride it where I like.
Is this the moment of the bike? Is this the chance for the humble bicycle to shine? Is it your time to pick up your pushy to hedge against those fuel bills? I'm Mary Guerin. This is The Conversation Hour. And I want to keep returning to conversations about how we get through this hard time. Maybe we even thrive out of the back of this hard time. And one silver lining, according to cycling enthusiasts, might be the rise of the bike. Tell me, are you dragging your neglected pushy out from the back of the shed? Just this week, you might not have heard that Victoria quietly released its active transport plan, and it's got an official goal we all now share. This plan is our roadmap to achieving a bold target, it says, 25% of all trips being active by 2030. So that's a quarter of all trips being walking or riding by 2030. We're going to be looking at this from a few different angles today. One of my guests is going to be asking whether we've built the conditions to make cycling a genuine choice for everyone. What do you think? Is it a genuine choice for you in your life? Maybe you're already doing it, you're doing it more, you're convincing other people in your life. Maybe there's a barrier in their way. Let me know. Are you all about that active transport? And as I say, we're going to be looking at it from a few different angles, such as, if you are now thinking about it, getting serious about it, you decide to buy a bike for the first time or the first time in a long time, how do you do it? When you walk into a shop, how do you choose what's right for you? We're going to be getting some tips on that. Also, how do you prepare your body if you're picking up the bike for the first time in a long while? We'll look at all of that and I'll have some guests with some tips for you. You might have some for us. So we will be talking about that already. Jane is texting saying, don't forget to talk about walking in this discussion. Walking and public transport access together in particular is what could revolutionise our cities. Indeed, I'd like to hear if you actually think that walking is better than cycling. Give me a call, 1300 222 774, and are there enough incentives for that? We will talk about active transport in response to this strange old time we're living in at the moment. Also later this hour, criminal animals, nature's most wanted, a cat who steals undies, pigs accused of murder, yes, all behind a new ABC podcast dropping today. We will get to that. But next, why bikes might be the answer for us again right now.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
It is coming up to 10 minutes past 11. Joining me now is Dr. Lauren Pearson, who's a research fellow in the School of Public Health and Preventative Medicine at Monash University. Hi, Lauren.
Good morning, Mary.
Now, when I talked to you this morning, you were just hopping off your e-bike. So you clearly are walking the walk, riding the ride. Tell us why bikes might be the answer that we're looking for right now.
Yeah, for sure. So we know that petrol is up above about $2.19 a litre now nationally, up about 50% of what was there before. And we know that even before this fuel crisis, the average Australian household was already spending about $20,000 a year just to own and run a car. So that's really one of our biggest expenses after housing. So this isn't really, you know, it's not just people reading about fuel costs in the news. This is something that people are feeling immediately and they're having to think about alternatives. And one of the positives is that more than half of all of our trips in Melbourne are under 5 kilometres, and that's pretty well within a cycling or walking distance for the shorter distances as well. That's about a pretty leisurely 20-minute ride. Yet only about 1.6 of trips are made by bike in Melbourne. And that's not so much because people don't want to. Our research found that it's actually 3 in 4 people in Victoria are wanting to ride a bike more. So the demand's there. What's really missing is kind of the conditions to make it feel safe and realistic compared to the alternatives.
You're listening to Dr. Lauren Pearson. We're talking about bikes, bicycles, cycling might be the answer to a lot of things at the moment. Peter, you've called in from Surry Hills. What do you think is lacking in our ability, as Lauren is talking about, to get to those bikes, even if we're wanting to?
Oh, hi. Yeah, look, the problem, I think, is around safety. Government's got strategies for building strategic cycling corridors and cycling networks, but strategies tend to sit on the shelf unless there's funding allocated to build safe infrastructure. So there's no sort of funding specifically for building any of these strategic cycling corridors. The ministers will tell you that the funding happens if a major project happens to come along, but that's no way to build a network. That just builds bits and pieces.
Peter, thank you. Lauren, what do you think of Peter's point? Is he right?
Yeah, absolutely, Peter. So our research has shown that really this concern around safety, so having to ride on the road alongside motor vehicle traffic, that is the biggest barrier that really prevents more people from hopping on a bike and using these this kind of mode of transport. Things like the strategic cycling corridors are extremely important, absolutely. So this is talking about mostly our protected networks. What we have seen is that, so 85% of our road network in Victoria is managed by local governments as well. So there's quite a bit of opportunity in terms of being able to support local governments to make changes that mean that people can make more kind of short trips within their areas rather than just thinking about the kind of trips we would use on our strategic cycling corridors. So thinking about, you know, our trips to the shop, to your school run, to a friend nearby, to the pool, the gym, these kind of things which are really in our local areas. And that's where we see other kinds of interventions which are lower cost come in. These are our things like 30-kilometre-an-hour speed limits, quiet waves. We've seen some of those implemented in Sydney, and also some really great examples of things like modal filters. So these are can be things like planter boxes, and it means that you don't get rat running through streets, but so you don't kind of have that kind of through traffic happening, and it makes it feel a lot more supportive and safer for people who are wanting to jump on a bike.
Yeah. Lauren, you talk about the responsibility at local council level. We've also got this active transport plan that was released during the week by the state government. How do you believe that that active transport plan is going to be effective and have some teeth behind it in making some of this stuff happen, if indeed a lot of these changes have to happen at the local council level?
Yeah, I really do. So the new active transport plan has a target of 25% of all trips made by walking or cycling by 2030, as you mentioned. That target's always been justified in terms of kind of health benefits, livability, climate. Now we have a much more force and urgent focus, which is it being affordable as well. What we've seen in this plan is this real shift towards recognition that getting people on bikes is not really about just supporting the kind of sporty, more confident cyclists, but also about supporting people of all ages and abilities to get out there and try and make a trip by bike. And they really understand now that that requires a range of support. So this is not only safe and supportive infrastructure, while that is extremely important. It's also other programs and policies that tackle other parts of behaviour. So things like purchasing subsidies. We've seen a real kind of explosion of popularity of e-bikes, e-cargo bikes, these kind of things which really enable a whole bunch more people to be able to jump on the bike and use this as a, you know, an easy mode of transport. And we've seen those kind of incentives implemented globally. And we've also seen them in places like Tasmania and in a couple of local governments around Melbourne, not quite at the state government level yet, but the plan really kind of sets that forward in motion, and that's an option.
I'm getting lots of texts about various hurdles that are in people's way, and I will get to those. But Luke has called in from Kensington. What would you like to say, Luke?
Oh, good morning, Mary. Look, I on this topic, I've come from a context and perspective of living in one of Europe's most livable cities, Vienna, for 10 years and comparing it to
Luke, it's just a little muffled there. I'm not sure if there's something happening with your phone, but you're saying that you lived in Vienna, is that right?
That's correct. Is that clearer?
It might. Yes, I think so.
Yeah, and just the different incentives we have here in Melbourne that go towards supporting single-use unicycle cars versus mass transport.
And yeah.
In Vienna, like the actual public transport, the motto is that this city belongs to you. And they incentivize people being able to access the city, to visit the hospitals, to go to the doctor, to go to childcare on public transport. We incentivize it in a car, and that just simply needs to change.
Yeah, Luke, we are having a little trouble hearing you, but I think we've heard what you've said, that there's this, you need to almost have a culture of this, imposed from above or from grassroots, Dr. Lauren Pearson. What would you say?
Yeah, from what I could hear in what Luke was saying.
Sorry, Luke.
No, absolutely right. So what we have really kind of made using the car the easy and most affordable choice at the moment, up until recent times, given the climate with fuel. We have these kind of opportunities to do that for bikes as well. And if I can run with a bit of an example here with cars, we have, you know, novated leasing, salary sacrificing, we have FBT exemptions for people buying electric vehicles, we have a huge amount of car parking, much of which is free, or we have, you know, car parking available at many of the places that we go. We don't have those kind of supports available for bikes. We have access to those kinds of things. So they can be things like salary sacrificing to purchase an e-bike or an e-cargo bike. And we've seen that implemented in some workplaces, but there isn't great support for it yet. At a political level, we see a whole lot of support at the community level. It's something that local governments want and are trying to make happen. So really it's now kind of up to that political will and ambition to match up to the Victorian Active Transport Plan.
Genevieve, in Warrnambool, you've got a bike because of the war in the Middle East. Is that right?
Yeah. Hi, Mary. I work in Warrnambool and live 15 kilometres out. Mm-hmm. I was thinking of getting a bike for fitness, then when the war started, I thought, well, I'll just go and do it. So I've been doing a mixture, putting the bike in the back of the car, going to work, and then riding home, and then riding back the next morning. So
15K is good on you, Genevieve.
Yeah, so I've got access to a rail trail, which is very handy. So, yeah, there's just one sort of section I'm sort of with traffic, but there is a bike lane, so, yeah, it's been good.
And that was specifically a nudge from the fuel price situation?
It was, yes.
Yeah. There you go, Lauren. Thank you, Genevieve. That's that in action. I must reflect that many of our texts coming through is talking about bicycle theft being a massive issue. This, Nadine has said, had her brand new bike stolen a couple of years ago, haven't ridden since. Ross in Flemington says, make sure first and foremost you have a good lock for your push bike. How much has that been part of the problem and how do you attack that?
Yeah, absolutely. It is a big problem. It is an issue. And again, this really comes down to making sure that we have the supportive environment to make sure we have things like secure and safe bike parking, rather than it maybe being tucked, you know, behind in an alleyway or at the end of a car park where you're not getting this kind of people walking past and that passive surveillance that we typically see. So where we have things like underground car parking in our newer apartment buildings, that's fantastic. But also I see a lot of people saying, if you are thinking about, you know, using a bike for your kind of short trips in your local area, whether it's just to the shop, to the pool, those kind of things, a lot of people tend to just get like a bit of a cheaper bike that they are more comfortable with. I wouldn't say happy, but more comfortable with if it does go missing. So if they don't have the option to have that kind of parking, that's often what we would hear. I did really want to come back to what Genevieve was talking about as well in terms of how she's now driving and then making part of the trip by the bike. And that is exactly such a fantastic example of the kind of things that people have the opportunity to do.
Yeah, getting a bit creative.
Exactly right, yeah. Not everyone can really swap their car for a bike in the current climate. You know, we've got freight drivers, some tradespeople, carers, our food supply chains, they, in the current climate, when they don't have a kind of electrified fleet, they depend on fuel. So everything, every kind of discretionary trip that we can make instead by walking, cycling, public transport, instead of the car, that really does free up that opportunity. So really great to hear a good example there.
Indeed. You're listening to Dr. Lauren Pearson from Monash University. We're talking about bikes, why they are the answer right now, potentially. Catherine has called in from Caulfield. What did you want to say? Hi, Catherine. Catherine, sorry, that was my bad. Sorry, Catherine. What would you like to say?
Hello. I'd like to feel safe riding my bike to the library and each of the streets to each of the libraries anywhere near me have just got a painted bike symbol on the road, and then that disappears even at every intersection. So you've got this scary thing going on at each intersection, and the roundabout, the five-way roundabout, is diabolical.
What would you have to say about that, Lauren?
Yeah, of course, Catherine. I can understand that for sure. Our research has shown, so we looked at the barriers that particularly women experience for riding a bike, and that having to ride on the road alongside motor vehicle traffic is the biggest concern. We see that most of our on-road infrastructure for bikes across Melbourne are painted bike lanes, unfortunately, and they really do not kind of dispel that concern that we have. Or, you know, you're often kind of sandwiched up between parked cars and cars that are moving. So if there are kind of trips that are available that do have access to kind of safe infrastructure, that's the one to go for. But in the meantime, this is exactly the kind of thing that we're saying. So we have, you know, 77% of women, 78% of all Victorians, they're wanting to make these kind of trips, but they're held back by these safety concerns, exactly what has just been highlighted. But people are wanting to make these trips, and it's the National Ride to School Day today on my ride.
Oh, as it happens.
What looks like really the whole of the western suburbs worth of kids riding their bikes to school, just having the absolute best time of their life. So that potential's there. The interest is there. Community support it. Local governments want this. Now it's really up to kind of taking that next level from both the state and the federal government in terms of financial investment to really put in not only the infrastructure but the other supports that we need to make this an everyday, easy, accessible choice.
Yeah, and I've had a few texts saying get those kids on bikes early because that really helps. Just as a final question, I just want to put to you, Lauren, we've had a few texts also about the regional city divide. Wayne says, all good ideas for you city slickers. So is my tax I pay living rural going forwards towards building bike lanes and paths in the city? We did hear from, I think it was Geraldine in Warrnambool, so she's living with it. But what would you have to say about that regional city divide?
Yeah, of course. Wayne, I can absolutely understand. I grew up in a regional town. I would say that actually getting around, walking and bike riding was the main way that we got around because fuel was extremely expensive. You've also got a lot of people who don't have access to cars. So thinking about younger people, older people, people who can't afford a car, there's a lot of people who are needing to make these kind of trips. And we're not so much saying, you know, you can't take the car, but this is just about making these kind of trips accessible, affordable, easy for a greater range of people. We've also seen some really good examples across regional centres of where they've been able to make this something that is really accessible. So particularly in the city of Greater Bendigo and in Mildura as well. So Mildura implemented some 30-kilometre an hour speeds across their CBD area, particularly in response to making that safer for people walking. And in Greater Bendigo, we've seen these incredible investments in safe infrastructure. So there's a low-line project, a beautiful bike path, which now goes along now down a waterway into the kind of centre of town and accessing things like playgrounds and parks as well. Mm. So there is some really great investment in our regional centres, which is great to see.
Slowly, slowly. Dr. Lauren Pearson, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Lauren Pearson, a research fellow in the School of Public Health and Preventative Medicine, Monash University. You are already raising so many issues here on Text. Going to some of those structural issues, the availability of these bike lanes, the safety issues, we're going to keep that conversation going with my next guest, Alison McCormack, the CEO of Bicycle Network. Hello, Alison.
Hello. What a great conversation. Thank you, Mary.
I can tell all the cyclists are very excited about this, and so am I, because I think that this is something that is a positive that we can be thinking about potentially out of this situation. Just before we go into how you choose a bike, the real basics of it, there, because we know that there are more choices out there really that might address some of the accessibility issues that I can already see up on text as well being raised. Before that, what would you have to say about that previous conversation we had about the policy structure that we have? We've got this Active Transport Victoria policy. You've been around this area for a long time. How much further do we need to go?
Look, we really need to think about exactly that, the funding of it and how it works across government as well. You touched on earlier the Active Transport Plan, and Minister Williams released that this week, and it's great that there's a plan. What we have spoken to her office about is that connection between state government and local councils. And this morning for National Ride to School Day, I was out at Newport Gardens Primary School. Over 40% of the students rode today, and over 40% walked, so just to the earlier caller, and being active and the energy, the electricity there, the parents were involved, was fantastic. And there was also a federal member there as well. So it's this connection between funding of federal, state and local council to ensure that there is that will and the coordination, because we see a lot of money wasted between the disjointedness of that. So it is so important.
Indeed. People are saying on text that it is about starting kids young as well. It's my impression that when I look around my friends, the cycling community is made up of rusted on people who were always going to cycle and they'll never stop cycling. And then there's the group like that we've heard of, Genevieve out in Warrnambool, who said, actually, it was a fuel crisis. That's nudged me to do something. Then there's this whole other group. And I admit to you, Alison, I'm part of it. Yeah. I didn't grow up with a bike. I'm a little bit scared of the traffic. My heart's in my mouth when my loved ones go on a bike. What can be done to help people like me? Draw me into your cult.
Yeah. Well, firstly, it's not a cult. It's okay.
Affectionately.
No, I get you. But it is so important. And the other thing to understand, we haven't mentioned it, it's actually a lot of fun. Mm. And it's social and it's so good for our health and well-being. 2 out of 10 students actively travel to school now. In the 70s and 80s, that was over 80%. Yeah, and wow. And we need to change this. You know, it's so good. Kids turn up to school ready to learn. Myself, there's not a day I don't commute into the city and speak to somebody. And that is so good for your mental health and well-being, your long-term health. It's an investment. It's a positive investment for government. So to get into it, it's not as difficult as the barrier feels sometimes. You know, most households have a bike in the garage. There's stock number one.
Maybe rusty, but
maybe
it's there.
You know, I'm suggesting maybe you might have one.
We do.
there's amazing community groups too. So if you feel that you're not quite sure where to start, put Bike Kitchen in your local suburb there, your local bicycle user group, go to the Bicycle Network website. There's a lot of resources there on how to start. And always also visit your local bike shop as well. We always suggest local, because local people know their own backyard. So talking about those barriers about safety, safe routes, taking the slower routes, sometimes you're not quite sure how to navigate those. So always your local bike shop, your local groups know exactly what the safest options are. They also know the barriers. Mm. So highly recommend starting there, because it's not as intimidating and it's a great way to start.
Maybe the real or perceived hurdles are not as big as you think. We will get down to the tin tacks of like what we're actually looking for when we go into one of those shops. But Paul has called in from Albert Park. You've bought an e-bike, is that right, Paul?
Yes, that's correct. It's probably very appropriate, the call at the moment. So I did my homework. I looked at the Victorian rules about e-bikes, that you're not supposed to go faster than 25 kilometres an hour, and there's usually limiters put on the bikes. You're supposed to have pedals on the bikes. So I purchased my e-bike, and then I found another rule, which I wasn't aware of, that the output cannot be more than 200 watts, which was disappointing. And when I checked Amazon, every online bike shop, it's nearly impossible to buy a bike where the output is under 200 watts, Alison, even the delivery bikes.
I'll just go to Alison McCormack. What do you know of those?
It's $250, and Paul, you're right. You have to be really wary buying e-bikes, and this again is why I say go to your local bike shop. It's worth buying a bike that is compliant. What we're seeing out there are e-motorbikes, and they are not often fit for purpose either. So the online ones that might be a lot cheaper are not safe because they haven't been battery tested. They haven't they might not follow those rules. So it's really important to make sure that you're buying something. And if you want the question, ask for an EU standard when it comes to e-bikes. That's the one number one question you
need to ask. So it really is buyer beware. You have to take that on.
You do. Yeah. And they're selling them, and people are selling them even in non-bike shops as well. So you've got to be really careful.
Paul, thanks for bringing up that very important point. Yvonne, you've called from Albury. What do you want to say about bikes?
Well, for a start, my son actually rides in Melbourne to work. But in Northern Europe, there are two things that they've got that we definitely haven't got here. They actually have bike garages, multi-storey bike garages in cities and near train stations. So you can ride to the station, leave your bike.
I've seen that in Copenhagen. It's impressive.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah.
And, I mean, we need places for people to leave their bikes that are safe. And secondly, in Europe and I think particularly in Denmark, they also have a law that if a car hits a cyclist, it's your fault. Now, I don't believe that. I don't agree with that totally because some cyclists do some really dumb things. But I have been abused when I've been on the bike. I've had cars come in close to scare me. The attitude towards cyclists is appalling.
Yvonne, I'm so glad you brought up this point because there is aggro either way that I've seen on, you know, with my own eyes, Alison. How do you combat that?
Yeah, and thanks for raising that. The first thing is that we actually do have some bike parking facilities at train stations across Victoria. There's 150 train stations with something called Parketeer, and we happen to manage it, but you can definitely use the Parketeers, and it's a start, but we need people to start using them because then that will grow, because I absolutely love those European facilities. In terms of road user behaviours, and that's what it is. And 95% of people, you know, might do the right thing and respect, but people who ride bikes are people who drive cars, who are people who walk. And we really need to shift that behaviour and that perception. Bike riding is a legitimate road user, and often we're put up against each other, and we need to get more people riding bikes because ultimately it's a generational change, like we see in Europe. Like we see people, a European will see a person on a bike and think, hey, that person could be driving a vehicle. Yep. You're actually saving me time. We really need to change the fundamental behaviours of people and their perception of people riding bikes. We're all part of the transport network. We're all getting around. Bike riding is much more efficient. So let's shift that behaviour. I completely agree.
Yvonne, thank you. I think it's a really important point that people often forget. Now, we've got a lot of texts talking about, yes, Copenhagen, Northern Europe seems to be the way to go here. We are talking also about just those basics. Andy says, any old bike will do to start, but if you want a good experience for commuting, spending more definitely pays off. We did hear Lauren suggest that maybe you could have a cheaper one if you're worried about theft. Where do you stand when you're walking into a bike shop, Alison? What's your basic bit of advice for people who just don't know what they're looking for?
Absolutely. So first of all, why are you riding? Are you commuting? You know, the short trip commutes, 50% of car trips are less than 4.2 km. Let's start there. You know, I want a good, reliable bike, something that's a good experience to ride. So you don't want to buy a cheap bike from a cheap store that isn't going to last more than 12 months. You know, you actually do want a good experience, and that's a great point. Probably your entry level can be anywhere from around $400, I would say, if you're buying something new, and then you could spend anything upwards. And as you go up in price brackets, really it's about weight of the bike, you know, better wheels, better components that will make the experience better. But you can certainly start on something to that $400 to $500 range to get going for the first time. Then if that's out of your budget, you could look at something like Facebook Marketplace. place, or go to these bike kitchens as well that are around that often refurb bikes.
Are they free, these bike kitchens?
You can turn up. There's all different ones. There's things like Series, It's Back on Your Bike, those type of things, and they recycle bikes. So you can go there and have a chat as well, because if you're a little bit intimidated by the bike shop, you can definitely go to the community groups, or you get one out of the garage, but make sure you follow your A, B, C, D, which is air in your tyres. B is the brakes. Make sure that the brakes are working. C is the chain, an oiled chain. Makes a world of a difference. And D is the drop test. So you don't drop the bike on the ground, but you just give it a drop. And if it's rattling, you know that you've got to tighten all the bits up. And anything beyond that, go to the bike shop.
Sounds like a good way to test if you're fit. Just drop. See if you rattle.
Yeah, I rattle.
Yeah, I rattle. I'm with Alison McCormack, the CEO of Bicycle Network. And Alison, I just want to put something to you that has been echoed a few times, that not everyone is physically able to ride a bike, say some texters. I'm a senior who can't due to physical limitations. I wish I could. What would you have to say about the range of bikes that are out there?
Yeah, and I do hear that, or people with arthritis is often, a reason why it limits people. Accessibility is really important. There are a number of accessible bikes, and there's amazing programs where people go into, seniors' homes, and then take people out for a ride, and it's absolutely amazing. But e-bikes really are a bit of a game changer in this space too. We're seeing our members increase in age, like their bike riding span increases 10 to 15 years with an e-bike, because it just does give that ability to get up the hill and things like that. But also for people who need to use their car for transport, if we're encouraging people to ride bikes on those short trips, it's taking the traffic off the road.
Yeah.
So that you are actually able to get from A to B in a car as well. I mean, imagine 50% of car trips less than 5 kilometres off the road.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a game changer.
I think there's some amazing stat about like millions of dollars that we're facing in terms of the cost of congestion over the next 10 years if we keep, driving our cars in this way. Points to Alan, who is talking about e-bikes. He says, my bike is acetylene powered. It was powered by acetylene legs. Good on you, Alan. I'll be honest. I'll read out any pun that's given to me. Thank you.
I'll use that.
Exactly. You'll like this, Alison. This on text. I've dusted off my bicycle, used it for the first time in more than a year for a short trip, 5 kilometres to town on a gravel bike path. It takes longer but is more enjoyable than driving. You get close to nature, the smells, sound and wind. The trip went well and I intend to do more cycling for short trips, not only to conserve fuel but also more enjoyable and no frustration finding a car park. Indeed. Wonderful.
Yeah, that's
all the good stuff.
It's exactly it. And it's fun. That's what I was saying earlier. Yeah. I think people get a lot more out of it than what they're expecting as well.
We are going to continue this conversation. It's 20 minutes to 12. I'm going to bring into the conversation now Dr. Eric Drinkwater, who is Senior Lecturer of Sports Science at Deakin University, because the next thing I want to pursue is how you prepare your body for a return to cycling, let alone your bike. Thank you for joining us, Eric.
Thanks for having me.
What do you think of the notion of getting more people up on bikes? Some people are talking about their physical limitations, but what are the good parts about picking up your pushy?
From a health perspective, or at least a fitness perspective, it's definitely to your cardiovascular system, like your heart, your brain, your general work capacity. All of that comes down to your cardiovascular health. So from a physical fitness perspective, I know there's lots of health benefits or mental health benefits as well, but from a physical fitness, it's to your cardiovascular system.
And what would you have to say to people who do have this, the physical limitations? What would you have to say to them about the pros and cons of a bike?
I think the pros certainly are to your physical health, but sometimes you really do need to think small and think local at the start. That chances are, if you're just considering this, then you're probably pretty well motivated. So you don't want to wreck that motivation by the first time you get on a bike, you plan to do a 20K ride into work and get 10 minutes in and then realize you're completely exhausted and just give it up because it's all too hard. So it's totally manageable, but you really do need to build up to it and start small and think small at the start.
We're talking to Dr. Eric Drinkwater. We're talking about how we prepare our body potentially for this moment of the bike. We're talking this hour about maybe bicycles are the answer in so many ways to these difficult times we're going through, not just, of course, because of the money that we might be saving through fuel, but also this was a long-term benefit potentially for us all. Eric, what would you have to say about the how you would get fit? You say start with smaller trips potentially if you haven't been on a bike for a long time. What sort of ways do you prepare your body when to get back onto a bike, and then how do you increase your fitness?
I mean, like I said, starting small is probably the best way to prepare that. Otherwise, I don't really want to overcomplicate it, that, you know, getting onto a bike and, you know, trying to think about, all right, well, you need a $5,000 bike and $1,000 worth of riding gear, and you need to do all of these stretches and training before you even get on. I don't really want to overcomplicate it, that if we want to get as many bikes onto the road as possible, I think it needs to be simple. So I think that's probably the place to start, is to just pull the bike out of the garage and give it a ride around the block and see how it feels. And if it feels all right, then go twice around the block. And then if that feels all right, we'll try to see if you can find a small hill to go up and see how that feels. And so I think it's just kind of gradually building into it and not trying to do that. You know, you try to capitalize on your huge amount of motivation when you first pull it out, and try to do too much, and then you just find it's too hard and give up. So, you know, building into it, I think, is the way to go.
Indeed. A question without notice on text here, Eric. How do you avoid saddle soreness?
I think probably making sure that it's proper. Your bike is properly fitted. That if you're getting that saddle soreness, it's at least partly related to maybe your bike isn't quite set up properly for you. So that if the seat is too high, it leads to your pelvis kind of rocking back and forth every time you push down on the pedals. And so that rocking back and forth, or maybe if your saddle is too far, a little too far back, then again, you have to lean forward more to reach the handlebars, which again puts that pressure through the saddle. So I think a lot of it would be related to your bike setup.
Dr. Eric Drinkwater, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
That's Dr. Eric Drinkwater, who is Senior Lecturer of Sports Science at Deakin University, because we're talking about getting ourselves back on our bikes. This could be the moment of the bike in these strange old times with the fuel prices. Very kindly, Alison McCormack, CEO of Bicycle Network, is still in the studio. I just want to put some more things that have come through on text to you, Alison, and this goes back to some of the things we have been discussing. Kristen from Ballarat says, my 13-year-old boy wants to ride 8 kilometres to school and back each day, but I won't let him. I've seen the way cars are not at all careful of bikes, and I'm so worried about him getting hit by a car. We have talked about safety and talked about, you know, there needs to be a culture change and so forth, but you can understand a mum not wanting to put her kid out there as some sort of experiment of our culture.
Yeah, and we do hear that. Often it's parents that are concerned about their children's safety. One thing we definitely advocate for, I was at a school this morning and I always make sure I ask the teachers, what would you change outside of school? Are there traffic treatments? The kiss and go zone, this is rural, so it's probably a little bit different. Often parents now are banding together in a bit of a volunteer system where they would ride in what we call a bike bus as well, in terms of, you know, the students start, so say this child is 8 kilometres away and then pick up students on the way, and the parents take a roster volunteering to lead that bike bus. And in a community, Lauren Pearson mentioned 2 speed limits around particularly school zones. 8 kilometres is a fair distance, obviously being in Ballarat. So again, it's working with government. You know, maybe we can lower the speeds in that school zone, getting parents on board. And the more we see students riding, so when 80% of students are riding, traffic is expecting those students as well.
And
when there's
adapt.
Not many students, exactly, it's not as safe, and that's the reality.
Kristen, I'd love to see if you actually think that that's possible in your community, and whether or not you're going to get on your bike as part of the bike bus. Rowan, you've called in from Bendigo. What do you think?
Oh, good morning. I just wanted to quickly, yeah, just say a couple of things, actually. But firstly, so my car broke down a couple of years ago and I was left, you know, carless for about 12 months before I could afford to get a new one. So I just got a, went into the bicycle shop and got an e-bike. And it was really, really enjoyable because the town that I live in, it's quite large in Victoria. It's not a very bike-friendly town, but so I started to take roads that weren't as busy. And I discovered all these beautiful little, really, really beautiful parts of the town that I'd not seen before that are inaccessible to vehicles. That was just a joy to ride down.
Rowan, yes, Alison is grinning here. It feels like, yes, she's hearing her people.
It's so true. But, I mean, that echoes exactly that. Even this morning, riding to the Ride to School program, I'm in St Kilda. Mm-hmm. So I rode with a colleague and we took the punt across the river on the Westgate, and that's the exact feeling. It was like we were cheating. And there's all these commuters on bikes catching the punt, and you just get to see and experience things that you just don't in a car. So I... on board 100%.
Absolutely cheering. Before we let you go, one last text was, your lady said someone who can give starter lessons for adults. Who was it?
Yeah, often the best way to do that, because it's so disparate, go to your local council, and they sometimes the council run Back on Your Bike. We run these Back on Your Bike programs across the place. We can always set one up as well. But local councils are a good spot to start, or the local bicycle user groups, and they'll be able to point you. But they're wonderful to go to.
Alison McCormack, I know I can say get on your bike and you take it the right way. Thank you so much for coming in as she holds up her helmet. Thank you for helping us in this conversation.
Oh, look, thank you so much for having it. It's a cheap way to get around. Get on your bike and let us know how you go.
Alison McCormack is CEO of Bicycle Network. So many more texts, and I will get to more of them. But we must get to a really wonderful podcast. You need to stick around for this. If you're wanting something else to listen to, something a little bit different, we're going to be telling you about a podcast that is showcasing the animals who've ended up on the wrong side of the law.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
It's 10 minutes to 12. Well, Stephen stole hundreds of packets of beef crisps. Stephen is a gull. He's one of many animals who've ended up on the wrong side of the law. Nature's most wanted. Cats who steal undies. A squirrel arrested for stalking. A pig accused of murder. What's going on? It's all part of a new podcast that's dropping today, bringing true crime and natural history together. Nature's Most Wanted is a new series from What the Duck? And here's a taste of what's in store for you. This is Professor Katie Barnett speaking about animals in court.
The question is, how do you know what the animal wants? We have some idea, right? The animal doesn't want to be killed, it doesn't want to be hurt, it doesn't want this, but... what exactly does it want, and how do you communicate that to the court? I mean, what they did in French times is they actually... I mean, it seems that they put them in the witness box and tried to interpret piggy grunts. Obviously, what you have to have is a human speaking for the animal.
What is going on? Dr. Anne Jones is presenter of Nature's Most Wanted and joins me now. What is going on, Dr. Anne?
Well, what Katie was talking about there is actually in medieval times when, well, there was a spate that lasted a couple of hundred years, actually, of animal trials, where animals were trialed sort of as if they had moral agency like a human would. And so there was a string, particularly of pigs, that got tried for murder.
Why pigs?
Well, one of the reasons was that there were a lot of pigs on the street. So there was a lot more contact between pigs and humans, partially because one way of honouring St. Anthony was by letting the runt of each pig litter roam free on the streets. So there was just these pigs everywhere. And pigs are terrifying. They're omnivores, and they will take advantage of any food they can sort of come across, and often that included, trigger warning, young children.
Yes.
So they often, on occasion, were killing or eating
young children. Okay, so
of the human variety.
Okay, this whole topic has taken turns that I did not see coming, Dr.
Anne. No, you didn't realise. So what they did, right, is they got those pigs, they apprehended them, put them into custody, and then put them on the stand, sometimes literally on the stand, but oftentimes with like an advocate that spoke for the animal. And then they were sentenced, and they were sometimes sentenced to like hard time, but mostly they were sentenced to death. They were hung.
Did any pigs talk their way out of it?
Yeah, look, there were some that actually didn't do too badly, because a lot of this had religious overtones in this period of time, right? Because there was a sort of moral judgment. And one of the cases was this a sow with a litter of piglets who were found eating human remains. Don't know if she killed it or not, but anyway, they were eating it. And the sow, the mother, the female got sentenced to death, but the young didn't, because the idea was is that you were born without sin.
Okay. So this is just one example of what you go to in your new series. It's called What the Duck, Nature's Most Wanted. It's talking about criminal animals, animals and crime. And Dr. Anne, this does go back to, it seems, this notion of, through history, assigning morality to animals. Is that right?
Yeah, because there was also in medieval times these ecclesiastical courts, right, which is a church court essentially, and these were, I think, mostly Catholic courts, and they tried all sorts of animals, weevils, beetles, slugs, woodworms, rats, like you name it, they put them on trial. And often the crimes that these animals were accused of were things that they would do naturally, like, you know, eating crops or you know, just like being pests, I suppose. And they put them on trial. They would give them an advocate, which is sort of similar to a lawyer. And oftentimes, not all the time, they had really quite complex conversations about what was right to do in these situations where you had an animal like a weevil in plague proportions eating a crop. And what they argued was that maybe weevils, you know, they've got a right. They were created by God too. They've got a right to exist. They've got a right to eat. And then the other people would say, oh, no, weevils. No, they are created by God, but should be in service of humans, right?
How did you find all of these stories, Dr. Anne?
Well, because I'm a dork.
do you like animals? Do you have pets, and do they, you know, commit crimes?
Yes, they do. They commit crimes of the heart.
yes,
every single day.
I was thinking that my golden retriever would be charged with love bombing.
Yeah.
For sure.
Manipulation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And my cats are just thinking about crime. I can just tell.
You can just tell. Yeah. Well, what's interesting is that in those medieval trials, I don't think there were any cats. It's quite interesting. There were dogs, there were donkeys, you know, all sorts of creatures. But I don't know that there were any cats.
It's because the cats were controlling the humans' minds.
Maybe. Or because they just don't respect the law.
They just,
you know,
don't. They knew. They just couldn't take them down.
Yeah.
I'm speaking to Dr. Anne Jones, the presenter of a new podcast. We've already getting questions. Where can we get this? It's called What the Duck, Nature's Most Wanted, and it'll be on the ABC Listen app or where you get your podcasts. Dr. Anne, the first episode drops today. You do talk about the pigs being tried for murder and the weevils. Also about Topsy the elephant. How long ago was Topsy the elephant in the US ridden into town by a drunken trainer? And who copped the rap for that?
Well, I think you can probably guess who copped the rap for it. But Topsy was, she was in the early 1900s. She was probably about 25 years old. She was a circus elephant, but she did kill a man, at least one man, because he fed her a lit cigar and she didn't like it, so she killed him. But then later on, her trainer, you know, the story goes on, the trainer did ride her into town, and then he got arrested for drunk and disorderly type behaviour, and she tried to follow him into the police station, and it caused absolute havoc. So Topsy got labelled as this rogue and, you know, murderous elephant. And Topsy was one of about, I think, 36 elephants that were executed in the United States, charged with things like murder and just being a rogue, bad creature that could not be handled. And they did kill them in all sorts of ways, including trying to hang them and electrocution. It's really dark stories.
Dr. Anne, who's this podcast pitched towards? Is it safe for all ages?
It's safe for all ages if you're willing to have conversations about the realities of life. What the Duck is made for Radio National, so that is an adult audience. So, but look, it's not all dark and dim history. There's stuff that happens in today. Like I, in like the scoop of the century, got to interview Leonardo da Vinci, which is a cat who likes to steal undies and socks from neighbours and has stolen in excess of 300 items and just brings them home. We've got security footage of Leonardo da Vinci. He's in New Zealand and it's just absolutely adorable.
I think this is the podcast we all need. Dr. Anne Jones, thank you so much.
Well, my pleasure.
Dr. Anne is presenting What the Duck? Nature's Most Wanted, and that is dropping today, like undies on the ground, pinched by a cat, on the ABC Listen app. That is all for today and this week. Thank you so much for joining me in the Conversation Hour. Look out for us on the ABC Listen app as well. Have a wonderful weekend.